You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the May 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of Green Gold by Willem Marx, with photos by Richard Moss. People from Scandinavia had arrived on a Greenland inhabited by Inuits in the mid-13th century, and the impacts of colonialism linger to this day, with the current secondary school syllabus still taught in Danish rather than the native Greenlandic tongue that is used in primary schools. Smaller settlements often lack educational provision for older children, making high school prohibitively expensive. On several domestic flights in Greenland, I sat beside a young teenager returning home from school or visiting a parent in a far-off settlement. A Greenlandic education historian estimates that by the end of colonial rule in 1953, there were just only a few college graduates in Greenland, all with Danish degrees. Today, only around 1 in 8 students who enter primary school finishes secondary school. While formally an autonomous territory, Greenland remains part of the Danmarksrige, or Danish realm. Its government must still defer to Denmark on matters of defense and foreign affairs, and it relies on Danish taxpayers for roughly half its $600 million annual budget. For some time, Greenlandic nationalists have argued the potentially lucrative revenues from mining could help replace that subsidy and strengthen the case for full independence. But Kleist, now retired from politics and working as a consultant to a foreign mining company, disagrees. "It's not a means to liberate the state of Greenland," he told me when we met in Nuuk, the fast-growing capital city. "Mining would never kind of pave the way for independence." The father of Naja Nathanielsen, Greenland's current mining minister, was also born in Kulisat, then sent to Denmark at 6 when his mother died. He never went home, Nathanielsen told me one morning when we met near the parliament building in Nuuk. Greenland has limited experience negotiating with well-funded foreign mining firms, but being late to the party, as she puts it, may provide advantages never available to a country like the DRC. "We were very much aware of what has been done around the world and what has been done wrong around the world," she said. In November, Nathanielsen spearheaded a ban on uranium extraction that may sink a joint Australian-Chinese mining project focused on rare earth elements. Months earlier, she and her ministerial colleagues had also ended oil and gas exploration because of severe risk of a potential spill. The World Wildlife Fund's project coordinator for Greenland approvingly described the prohibition as a gutsy move, particularly given the potential for tax revenues. But Nathanielsen insists it was a no-brainer for a nation with a pristine Arctic environment where fishing provides thousands of jobs and a huge chunk of economic output. She is broadly supportive of the mining sector, but plans to update transparency and environmental requirements. Currently, just 2 small mines operate in the entire country, extracting rubies and preparing to mine anorthosite, a mineral used in manufacturing. All this might make Trump's pseudo-imperial fantasy of buying Greenland not sound like such a lark, though that proposal ultimately ended up as a $12 million economic grant to encourage mining cooperation. At Greenland's only mining school, where students learn to dynamite rocks and build pit roads, The director has developed a $1 million partnership with U.S. counterparts to help construct a training facility for an underground mine, the kind that might be built on Disco. Well before that, though, Blue Jay will need to sign an impact benefit agreement with the local community that could include government, that could include employment guarantees. And given that any mine would be dozens of miles from the nearest residents with no roads in sight, as one Greenlandic investment expert speculated, without foreign labor, you will not be able to run projects like this. Toon, the technical lead at Breakthrough Energy Ventures Investment Committee, says the hardest and fastest race will be to complete the global energy transition before it's too late. The electrification of transportation is something that absolutely has to happen if we're to make a significant impact on the production of greenhouse gases, he says. While virtually all batteries used toward that effort today still require cobalt mined in the DRC, under conditions that I don't think any of us would be comfortable with. Within the next few years, if enough new deposits have been discovered elsewhere, in Greenland or Australia or maybe Canada, it still will not solve that problem fast enough. But the desire to make money may ultimately be the only solution available. As Toon says, the kind of capital that's necessary to do what we want to do here is going to come from investors who are seeking to earn a return. While I was reporting this story, Glencore invited me to see KOV firsthand. It is currently the world's largest source of cobalt and is still a cash tap for Gertler, with Glencore's KOV anchored complex netting him $20,000 every hour or so in mining royalties. The vast canyon of minerals stretches more than a mile across and more than 1,000 feet deep. A geological kaleidoscope of oxidation fans out from beneath an observation deck on its northeastern flank, flaming red and bright lilac tinged with dark green. My December visit followed torrential rain, and black pipes as thick as culverts snaked into multi-million-dollar pumping stations to combat the streams of water. Every hour in the dry season, hulking shovel machines dump 3,000 tons of earth into enormous trucks that trundle up sloped roads cut into the mine's walls. Radar dishes scanned for any concerning movement. Several years ago, 7 workers died in a wall collapse. In 2019, more than 40 local creuseurs, French for diggers, died when a section of KOV they were excavating without the mine operator's permission collapsed. Of the 9,000 staff and contractors Glencore employs around Kolwezi, some 1,200 now work in security, and the company has clearly made and continues to make significant efforts to stop similar intrusions. Just outside Glencore's concession, now largely ringed by 24 miles of concrete blast walls, like the ones that surrounded U.S. military installations in Iraq and Afghanistan, an enthusiastic team of Congolese community liaisons greeted me and took me on a tour of a clean but empty new maternity clinic in Kamoto, a village that abuts the pits. Departing the clinic, we passed clusters of workers scavenging chunks of ore from a small pond at the village edge. The trucks from KOV dump their loads near the pit's edge, where miles of conveyor belts carry the material to a complex that transforms it into sheets of copper metal or powdery blue-green cobalt hydroxide, which is then poured into vast piles of 1,300-pound white canvas bags and trucked to East African ports, destined for yet more processing, primarily in China. Rusting freight train carriages lie in piles beside the gutted road, on land still controlled by Kikamines or Gecamines, the Congolese state-owned mining company that is a non-operational partner in most of the company's larger mines. Clint Duncan, Glencore's top copper executive in Africa, explains how complex it has proven to be to run a professionalized operation here. The concession is spread out over a large area, he says, and in amongst it is the infrastructure from the original workings. He was referring to various plots of land and aging facilities that separate Glencore's underground mine from the vast pits and the refinery, which uses a chain of processes, including towering crushers, mills, and concentration systems, to convert ore into shining squares of copper and mountains of cobalt hydroxide. Back in 2006, the refining and concentrating facilities Duncan showed me were the only ones in the area, but belonged to a Canadian competitor of Nicanor called Katanga. Its CEO, Arthur Art Ditto, was not initially interested in pooling resources with Nicanor, but over time, the capital-intensive nature of restarting a mine depleted Katanga's funds, just as credit markets tightened ahead of the 2008 financial crisis. What came next was almost a transactional replica of how Gertler had gained control of Nicanor. His offshore firms grew his stake in Katanga. Glencore kicked in $265 million in loans to Katanga, while also loaning money to Gertler's companies, again undisclosed at the time. Within 2 years, all the original partners and competitors saw their shares diluted to the point of irrelevance. "I couldn't trust Dan further than I could throw him," said Eric Lilford, a former Nicanor board member Benny Steinmetz had brought in, who resigned when the merger was announced for personal reasons, calling Gertler as crooked as they come. Ditto, who resigned as Katanga's CEO soon after the merger, said Gertler and Glencore executives had operated like they were in the Wild West, avoiding disclosure to mask their long-held ambition to combine the various mining assets. "These were guys," he told me by phone from his retirement home in Arizona, "who play the game under different rules, a different way, in a way that I couldn't. Nicanor had burned through cash as well, though, and would have been an abject failure for J.P. Morgan and the people who put money in without the merger, one mining executive told me, because it was no chance of ever being mined. The DRC's mining minister, whose department had once chosen to separate the two projects, welcomed the milestone transaction. But by the time of the merger's completion, in late 2007, almost a decade of fuzzy and sometimes iniquitous purchases by foreign investors of the country's most valuable mining rights, including at KOV, had begun drawing international scrutiny. Pressure from foreign NGOs in particular led the government to re-examine deals struck in the early years of the Kabila administration, a review that eventually led many foreign firms to pay sizable rebalancing payments back to the government to cement their existing rights. At a Zurich Airport Hotel conference room in mid-2008, Katanga's board gave Gertler the mandate to lead negotiations with Congolese authorities over its own settlement payment. In just 2 weeks, he negotiated down the requested total payment from $585 million to $140 million. The eventual settlement for KOV, his first big asset in the region, dropped from an initial request of $240 million to just $5 million. And on it goes. Gertler bought a stake in another cobalt mine called Mukondo Mountain, and almost immediately work there halted while he renegotiated profit sharing with the mine's operator, a firm called Kemek. Not long afterward, Kemek's CEO, Andrew Groves, tried to buy Katanga before Gertler and Glencore could, and saw that effort stymied when his firm's mining permit was unexpectedly suspended by the Congolese government. Within months, Gertler and Glencore controlled the combined Nicanor Katanga, and Kamek had announced a joint venture with Gertler at Macondo. Groves hailed him in a press release as one of the leading and most successful investors in DRC. Days later, Kamek's permit suspension was lifted. Over a recent breakfast in London, Groves told me that he suspected interference from competitors led to the permit threat. But he didn't criticize Gertler, calling him a fellow fighter. One of the most thorough delineations of Gertler's modus operandi came in 2016, when the Department of Justice reached a settlement with Oak Ziff Capital Management Group for $213 million and the hedge fund's admission of guilt in a scheme to bribe officials in the DRC and Libya. Oak Ziff has since rebranded as Sculptor Capital and is publicly traded NYSE, SCU, with more than $37 billion under management. That agreement obliquely referred to a DRC partner throughout, widely reported to be Gertler. Gertler did not comment. According to the Department of Justice, Oak Ziff had an agreement with a DRC partner to fund mine acquisitions in the DRC and was aware that the tactics likely involved payment to public officials, which would be a violation of the U.S. Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. The DRC landscape is in the making, and I am shaping it like no one else. The DRC partner emailed a London-based Oak Ziff partner in 2008. Gertler has continued to deny the settlement agreement's premise that he made around $100 million in bribe payments between 2005 and 2015. In December 2017, the U.S. government directly accused Gertler of having amassed his fortune through hundreds of millions of dollars worth of opaque and corrupt mining and oil deals, and the Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control added him to a sanctions list, alongside a raft of his businesses. In February 2017, Glencore paid $534 million to buy out Gertler's remaining shares in Katanga and another mine, but he was still left holding some previously acquired royalties. The office of the DRC's president announced that one of Gertler's companies will return some $2 billion of oil and mining assets to the country, more than 2% of its GDP. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz reported that, according to sources with knowledge of the proceedings, Gertler's representatives proposed he serve time in an Israeli prison in exchange for the closure of the investigations against him. Gertler's lawyer told Haaretz that no negotiations are being conducted on Gertler's behalf with any law enforcement authority. A representative told Vanity Fair the report is utter nonsense. For Brad Brooks Rubin, a lawyer at OFAC during the George W. Bush administration and at the State Department under President Obama, the announcement highlighted concerns that sanctions can often come a few steps behind what actors like Gertler are trying to do. Brooks Rubin, currently a senior advisor at the Sentry, an investigative and political organization founded by John Prendergast and George Clooney, say enforcement requires greater action. The government investigations have kept on coming, though, even if they take years to resolve. A senior Glencore executive, Aristoteles Mistikidis, who had been appointed in 2008 to the board of Katanga, faced penalties in a December 2018 settlement with the Ontario Securities Commission, as Katanga was on the Toronto Stock Exchange. The commission accused Katanga's officers of having failed to disclose material risk to its business, specifically public sector corruption in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and the nature and extent of Katanga's reliance on individuals and entities associated with Dan Gertler. Glencore delisted Katanga from the exchange just as the pandemic was exploding in April 2020 and still faces the American, British, and Swiss investigations. In its past two financial reports, Glencore had said it was not possible to predict or estimate the size or scale of the fines, penalties, or subsequent lawsuits that could stem from these various investigations. But in February, the firm announced it was putting aside $1.5 billion to resolve U.S., U.K., and Brazilian inquiries, while Swiss and Dutch authorities continued their own probes. Tony Hayward, Glencore's chairman since 2013, who was replaced as BP CEO after the Deepwater Horizon disaster, stepped down last summer and was replaced by Kalidas Madhavpeddi. He'd led the Chinese mining giant China Molybdenum, which had been racing to match Glencore's Congolese cobalt output, until this winter, when local authorities seized its largest asset. As a confidant of then-President Kabila, Gertler played a role in bringing peace to the DRC in the early 2000s, according to one former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State, even traveling to Washington in an effort to end the drawn-out conflict. But almost two decades on, he has been fighting his own kind of rearguard action for influence in the U.S. Capitol, hiring former FBI Director Louis Freeh's lobbying firm in late 2019 with Dershowitz as part of his team. In the chaotic days following the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol last year, the Trump administration granted Gertler a year-long exemption from the earlier sanctions, allowing him to transfer any funds that had sat frozen in U.S. accounts. Treasury Secretary Mnuchin approved the special license without the knowledge of several senior State Department officials. Biden reimposed sanctions quickly after taking office, following condemnation from several Democratic senators and representatives. Meanwhile, Gertler, or his proxies, began to register new companies, often in Kinshasa rather than the Caribbean. He also began visiting a Congolese branch of a Cameroonian bank, Afriland First Bank, which businessmen with links to Hezbollah and the North Korean government have allegedly used to evade their own U.S. sanctions by ensuring that international transfers from that bank, including via the SWIFT system, do not share identifying details of transactions. Gertler has denied trying to evade sanctions and any wrongdoing. Navy Malela, a former auditor at the bank, told me that when he saw the freshly sanctioned Gertler walk past his office in 2018, it was like seeing a phantom. Malela called a trusted colleague into his office and warned the coworker that if the man who had just walked down the corridor began to frequent their business, we will have problems. Malela and the colleague worked to alert the bank's board to the presence of Gertler-linked accounts and suggested they be frozen. But in response, both received threats from upper management. The two men eventually became whistleblowers in a series of sprawling accusations that involved foreign nationals and entities. Fearing for their lives, they fled Kinshasa and now live in undisclosed European locations. Lawyers for Afriland have accused the men of stealing and falsifying bank data. Dan Gertler inserted himself into every bloody mining transaction. He took an equity stake or a royalty or both, says Lilford, the former Nicanor director. But Gertler has said his deal-making has attracted unprecedented investment to the country, pushing up tax revenues and supporting local communities. He told one journalist that he should be offered a Nobel Prize, while his old friend Kabila, whose father once fought alongside Che Guevara in an earlier Congolese conflict, said Gertler had braved the hurricane during the country's difficult period after the Civil War, when others had abandoned the DRC. Gertler visits the DRC less frequently nowadays, spending more time at his home outside Tel Aviv, but he did travel to Kinshasa in late February to sign an amicable agreement with the country's justice minister to end ongoing litigation between the two sides. DRC President Felix Tshisekedi, as well as the DRC's finance and mining ministers, refused repeated interview requests. One of Kabila's most influential appointees, the wealthy former chairman of the state mining company, Albert Yuma, once insisted to a local interviewer that Gertler's wealth was the fair reward for taking the risk. And while a businessman with long experience in the DRC and with Gertler told me that since everyone is corrupt, everyone holds hands to protect one another, there are signs that a new DRC administration is seeking to change that status quo. During a speech in Kolwezi in May 2021, Tshisekedi told his audience he was tired of the situation I've been seeing in this country for years now. People are coming here with nothing in their pockets, but they go back to become billionaires while we ourselves still remain poor. Confessions of a Mob Chef. In the 1980s and 1990s, David Ruggiero was a rising star of French cooking in New York and a proto-celebrity chef with cookbooks and TV shows to his name. But all that success in the kitchen belied the double life he was leading as a rank-and-file member of the mob. Decades after his fall from grace and mysterious disappearance from the food world, Ruggiero is coming clean, by Gabriel Sherman, with photographs by Gillian Laub. First photo, open kitchen. David Ruggiero in his Long Island home last winter. And he stands at the counter of a very well-appointed kitchen with a large knife, getting ready to chop vegetables. By the time he was 30, David Ruggiero had helmed kitchens at the finest French restaurants of 1990s New York, La Caravelle, Maxim's, and Le Chantilly. A Brooklyn-born boxer turned chef, Ruggiero cooked for presidents past and future, Richard Nixon, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, and Donald Trump. Wall Street titans, Stephen Schwarzman, Lloyd Blankfein, and Jamie Dimon. Media moguls, Michael Bloomberg and Martha Stewart. Hollywood royalty, Sophia Loren. And actual royalty, Prince Albert of Monaco. The New York Times food critic Brian Miller twice awarded Ruggiero's restaurants 3 stars. New York Magazine's Gail Green hailed his cooking at Le Chantilly as a miracle on 57th Street. PBS aired his series Little Italy with David Ruggiero, and Food Network gave him a primetime show, Ruggiero to Go. With his forget-about-it persona and wise guy quips, you know what I mean, Ruggiero was rocketing toward Emeril Lagasse-level stardom. But it all blew up on the afternoon of Thursday, July 2nd, 1998, when police entered Le Chantilly with a search warrant. The Manhattan District Attorney charged Ruggiero with defrauding a credit card company out of $190,000 by inflating diners' tips, in one instance by as much as $30,000. Ruggiero initially denied the allegations, but facing 15 years in prison, he pleaded guilty to attempted grand larceny in exchange for 5 years probation and an agreement to pay $100,000 in restitution. Within months, Food Network canceled his show, his restaurants closed, and he filed for personal bankruptcy. Then he disappeared from the food world. Overnight it was gone, Ruggiero recalled one afternoon last fall, as he sautéed onions in the cluttered kitchen of his modest home at the end of a Long Island cul-de-sac. Now 59, his refrigerator-sized body and T-bone-thick hands made him appear too big for the cramped room. He was preparing an ambitious lunch menu, goat cheese terrine, mignon of lobster, wood-fired roast chicken, and creme brulee. An open laptop rested on a small desk next to the dining table. It's where Ruggiero has been writing his memoirs, which recount his rise to the highest echelon of the New York restaurant world, but also reveal the secret he kept along the way. He was, for decades, including the entirety of his cooking career, a working member of the Gambino mafia family. I was living 2 lives, Ruggiero told me. I was introduced to Ruggiero in the spring of 2021 by friends who said he was ready to go on the record about his years in the mob. Ruggiero's operatic rise and fall sounded like one of the most improbable career arcs I'd heard about, one part Goodfellas, another Kitchen Confidential. Over the summer and fall, I interviewed Ruggiero about his life of cooking and crime, the first time he's spoken about his time in the underworld to a journalist. The name David Ruggiero is itself an invention. According to his baptismal certificate, he was born Sabatino Antonino Gambino on June 26, 1962. Ruggiero's Sicilian father, Saverio Erasmo Gambino, was a cousin of Carlo Gambino, the infamous boss of bosses, who ruled New York's five mafia families in the 1960s and 70s. In the 1980s, Ruggiero joined a Brooklyn crew run by Gambino capo Daniel Marino. Ruggiero said his own mob resume includes heroin dealing, truck hijackings, loan sharking, bookmaking, extortion, and participating in several notorious gangland murders. He said he steered lucrative restaurant supply contracts to mob-connected vendors and bribed union officials to keep his kitchens non-union. In recent years, though, he said he was motivated by feelings of guilt and betrayal to violate his sacred vow to uphold omerta. In 2014, Ruggiero's 27-year-old son, an aspiring gangster, died from an apparent drug overdose. Ruggiero felt responsible. He was deeply wounded and enraged that Marino didn't show up at the funeral. "When Danny didn't come, that's when I said, 'F this, I'm done,'" Ruggiero told me. Though his old capo was under house arrest at the time, Ruggiero insisted such conditions weren't exactly encumbrances for the guys he knew. "A wake was a reason that his parole officer would have okayed in a split second," Ruggiero said. During our conversations, Ruggiero toggled between the rarefied backdrop of gourmet cuisine and unspeakable street violence, some of which he was committing himself. His stories provided a singular glimpse of late 20th century New York, the twilight years of both French cuisine and the mob in the city, when the New York Times credibly described La Caravelle as an elegant midtown temple to French gastronomy, and federal authorities were systematically dismantling the New York families, case by case. It was also a time before everyone carried a camera in their pocket. Rich and famous New Yorkers could be their unvarnished selves in public, and no one outside the dining room would know about it. Ruggiero's restaurants were stages for some truly outrageous episodes. In the author's note of his unpublished memoir, Ruggiero writes, "Everything within these pages is accurate. There was no need to embellish. The truths were horrific enough. At times, though, I questioned if he was exaggerating for dramatic effect, as wise guys have been known to do. I cross-checked names and dates he cited with contemporaneous newspaper accounts, public records, court filings, and personal photographs. I also spoke to former FBI agents and Ruggiero's former employees, who confirmed mobsters were frequently hanging around his restaurants. Bruce Moe, who ran the FBI's Gambino squad in the 1980s and 90s, confirmed La Chantilly was one of Danny Marino's haunts. We knew it was a hangout, he said. Moe's successor on the Gambino squad, Phil Scala, confirmed that Ruggiero was a member of Marino's crew. Danny would tout Ruggiero and invite all his friends to his restaurants, Scala said. When you called about David, my first thought was, is this the FBI calling? Said Don Dubois, a former corporate attorney who worked at Le Chantilly. I remember we once owed money to a meat company. A guy walked into the restaurant with a baseball bat and said, you better pay, or I'm coming back and using this. I'm this nice girl from Brooklyn thinking, what in the hell? Ruggiero was candid during our conversations, sometimes shockingly so. But members of organized crime are, not surprisingly, just as organized about what they admit to and what they don't. As he detailed the shadow life he led while rising through the city's finest kitchens, Ruggiero openly discussed brutal crimes he committed with mobsters who are dead. He was circumspect, though, when I ask about more recent activities. Ruggiero was adamant that while he quit the mob, he didn't want to get any current Gambino members in trouble. I will not cooperate against anyone. That isn't why I did this, he told me. Over lunch, I asked if he was worried that he could implicate himself or become a target of the mob for going public. I'll let the chips fall where they may. After I lost my son, I knew that this has to end with me, he said. Ruggiero described his Brooklyn childhood as a series of Dickensian tragedies. Before he was born out of wedlock, his father, Saverio, a prolific heroin trafficker, was deported from Brooklyn to Sicily and jailed in Palermo's infamous Usardone prison. When Ruggiero was about 4, he says he found his infant sister dead in her crib. Her coffin was so tiny we didn't need a hearse, Ruggiero recalled. A year later, he watched his pregnant mother die in bed during an asthma attack. The last memory of my mother was watching them carry her lifeless body out of the house. After Ruggiero's father went to jail, Ruggiero's mother remarried one of his friends, who agreed to adopt her son but demanded he change his first and last names. He beat me every chance he had, Ruggiero said of the man. Ruggiero took David after his mother's favorite movie, the 1962 psych ward love story David and Lisa. His sister took Lisa. Ruggiero hated his adoptive father's last name and later took Ruggiero, the Americanized spelling of his grandmother's maiden name, Ruggiero. Her nephew, Angelo Ruggiero, would become Gambino boss John Gotti's confidant. The adoptive father could not be reached for comment. When his mother died, Ruggiero's adoptive father sent David and Lisa to live with their maternal grandparents in Park Slope, and later the East Flatbush section of Brooklyn, a middle-class enclave where Barbara Streisand and Rudy Giuliani grew up a generation prior. My mother's family was as straight as an arrow, Ruggiero recalled. According to public records, his grandfather had been an administrator for the New York City Department of Corrections. But by the 1960s, East Flatbush had become one of the city's roughest neighborhoods. It was a different time in Brooklyn. There were so many murders, Ruggiero recalled. Ruggiero said his grandmother made the kitchen an oasis. To watch her hand make pasta, knead bread, or simply jar vegetables was a joy. Everything she did was with such care and precision, he said. Grim reality soon intruded. Not long after the move, Ruggiero's grandfather had a heart attack. Ruggiero said he found him collapsed in the bathtub. Ruggiero believes his early experiences with death stripped him of his ability to feel empathy. I learned early that I had a very cold side to me, he said. The toughness was also a survival tactic. By elementary school, Ruggiero had started his first hustles. He ran a 3-card Monte game and soon graduated to selling stolen Christmas trees, fireworks, and Jordache jeans for local wise guys. He honed his fighting skills at a local gym owned by the famous Jewish boxer Izzy Zierling. Around this time, Ruggiero recorded his first of multiple arrests for gambling and fighting. Did I want to be a gangster? Never one day did I say to myself, yeah, I want to be a gangster when I grow up, he recalled. All I wanted to do was survive the next day. Ruggiero fell in with one of his father's trusted lieutenants, named Egidio Ernie Boy Onorato. Ernie was younger than my father and weighed about 155 pounds, but he was the most ruthless gangster I ever saw, Ruggiero said. Onorato died in 1998, which liberated Ruggiero to talk about his mentor. According to Ruggiero, wise guys nicknamed Ernie M&M, short for Murder and Mayhem. Ruggiero recalled one night when he was 11 years old that he accompanied Onorato, then 23, to the Alley Cat Bar on the Lower East Side, and waited on the street, while Onorato went in and lured a federal informant named Anthony Finn to an alley. Ruggiero said he watched Onorato beat Finn to death, and then shoot him and stuff a packet of coke in his mouth. "We loaded the body into a car and drove it over to Avenue A and 9th Street," Ruggiero said. On March 4th, 1974, the New York Times reported a 33-year-old Bronx man was found dead in his car on the Lower East Side with a bullet wound in the back of the head shortly before 11 a.m. in what the police said was a gangland-style slaying. The police identified him as Anthony Finn. Onorato and Ruggiero were never publicly linked to the crime. Two men, Luis Santos and Salvatore Scudiero, were later convicted for conspiracy to commit murder. In 1976, when Ruggiero was 13, his father was released from prison and returned to Brooklyn. Ruggiero was on edge, having to explain that he gave up the Gambino name. "When I told him about my name, he just said, 'We'll take care of that.' He never called me David. It was always Sabatino," Ruggiero recalled. Saverio opened a fish market and a car service in nearby Mill Basin, Brooklyn, and put Ruggiero to work. He did loan sharking out of the car service and brought in heroin to the fish market, Ruggiero recalled, as he showed me the storefronts on a hazy July afternoon. They were bringing in sardines, squid, and octopus, frozen in 2.2-pound boxes, he said. In the center of the fish was pure heroin. When it landed here, the dogs couldn't smell it. Ruggiero worked out of another one of his father's front companies, a dog grooming store. To make some extra money, Ruggiero said he started dealing exotic animals in the back. One Christmas, Ruggiero said Gambino capo Frank Piccolo, also known as Frank Lanza, who was famously indicted in 1980 for conspiring to extort singer Wayne Newton, bought a monkey named Bongo for his grandchildren. Soon after, Piccolo demanded Ruggiero take him back. "I let that blank blank out of the cage, and now all he does is sit in the corner, shit, and throw it at me," Ruggiero remembered Piccolo screaming over the phone. Ruggiero said he and a friend took the monkey back and let him loose in the Prospect Park Zoo late one night. As Ruggiero prepared to start high school in the summer of 1977, his father took him to Sicily to be made. Ruggiero said Santo Inzerello, the brother of Palermo boss Tuccio Inzerello, presided over the ceremony in the basement of a cafe in Castelmar del Golfo, his family's ancestral village. A man used a dirty needle to tattoo Ruggiero's right shoulder with a fiery cross image. The tattoo includes the words Uomo de Fiducia, Italian for man of trust. Shortly after father and son returned to Brooklyn, Saverio was arrested again and deported to an Italian jail. Before going away, Saverio assigned Onorato to look after Ruggiero. By this point, Ruggiero was participating in Ernie's brutality. Ruggiero said that in March 1978, he helped Onorato torture and kill a 56-year-old Genovese and Colombo associate named Pasquale Paddy Mac Macarol at a tire repair garage in Yonkers, New York. Ruggiero said they left Macarol's corpse in a car trunk in Brooklyn. On March 24, 1978, the New York Times reported, "The police found Mr. Macarol's body yesterday after his family received an anonymous phone call telling them where to look. He had been missing for 3 weeks. Onorato rewarded teenage Ruggiero handsomely. Ernie had a house down in Fort Lauderdale. It had a sunken living room, and in the middle was a big coffee table. There was always a quarter or half kilo of coke piled up on it. Ernie used to have girls over, and everybody was naked. For me, sex at 14 and 15 wasn't a big deal," Ruggiero said. Public records show Onorato's name associated with an address on Sea Island Drive in Fort Lauderdale. Ruggiero said during his teenage years he earned $50,000 from drug dealing, about $230,000 in today's dollars, which he hid in the attic of his grandmother's home. When I was 16, I sent my grandmother and my sister on a month-long tour of Italy, he recalled. The thrills didn't last, however. In the summer of 1980, Ruggiero's friends started dying. Ruggiero said the first to go was a 22-year-old aspiring stand-up comic named Joey Skeech Cannizzaro. Skeech was a wannabe. He was effing crazy to be a gangster, Ruggiero said. On the way to meet Onorato one night, Ruggiero noticed that Cannizzaro was limping. He tells me he had fallen in love with a Jewish girl, and she made him get circumcised. He showed me a gold chain around his neck. On it, there looked like there was a dried-up piece of chicken. It was foreskin. I said, "Get rid of that effing thing, and whatever you do, don't tell Ernie." They drove to a burned-out building in East New York, where Onorato sent Cannizzaro out for Chinese food. Everybody's grabbing cartons off the table. Skeech leans over, and his effing gold chain falls out, and Ernie goes, What the F is that? I put my hands over my head because Skeech starts telling the story of getting circumcised. I'm looking at Ernie, and there was no expression on his face. Nothing. Against the chair, there was a lead pipe. Ernie picked up the lead pipe, and he went berserk. He beat this kid to the point where you couldn't recognize him anymore. Ernie whirled around, and I thought, I'm getting killed next. He put the pipe an inch from my face. It was dripping blood. He says, "You brought this effing guy around. He's your effing problem." So we started wrapping Skeech's body in an old rug. That's when I heard Skeech moaning. Turns out he was alive. Ruggiero said he weighed Skeech's body down with lead window sashes and dumped him in the water near Sheepshead Bay. According to Social Security Administration death records, Cannizzaro was 22 when he died in June 1980. In July 1981, Ruggiero's best friend, a 21-year-old bodybuilder named Cesar Giuliani, was found dead, shot in the head. Behind the steering wheel of a car parked in Brooklyn, Ruggiero believed Onorato killed Giuliani on the orders of a Bronx wise guy whose girlfriend Giuliani was sleeping with. According to public records, Giuliani was buried on July 16, 1981, in Suffolk County, New York. Next, photos, pressure cooker. Ruggiero in his teenage boxing days. In the kitchen of Maxim's, while hosting the meal of the century with chefs Gray Kunz, Michel Richard, and Jean-Louis Paladin with Jacques Pepin of the James Beard House on a PBS cooking show set. Not long after Giuliani's murder, Ruggiero said his girlfriend overdosed and drowned at Jones Beach on Long Island. Her friends told Ruggiero she took pills Onorato had given her. Ruggiero believed Onorato had given her pure heroin because he was angry about how much time Ruggiero was spending with her. "That's when I decided I was going to kill him," Ruggiero said. Ruggiero said he planned to kidnap his mentor and murder him in the back of a stolen Good Humor ice cream truck. But before he executed the plot, a Gambino soldier named Peter Little Pete Tambon intervened. Little Pete was probably about 4'6". He goes, "I know this guy Ernie is with your father, but let's be honest, he's usura dement," a Sicilian term for going crazy. He then says, "You're going to kill him and go to jail, or he's going to kill you, or you're both going to die. On Friday, you come to Grotta d'Oro." Grotta d'Oro was a popular Italian restaurant in Sheepshead Bay. On Friday nights, Gambino capo Carmine Lombardosi conducted business there out of his Rolls Royce parked out front. Lombardosi was possibly the Gambino family's biggest earner. He specialized in pump-and-dump stock market fraud and loan sharking. His nickname was the King of Wall Street. When Ruggiero showed up, Little Pete waved him over. Lombardosi whispered to Ruggiero that he would be working for him. The message was clear. Ruggiero couldn't touch Ernie Onorato, but Onorato couldn't touch him either. Carmine was the 900-pound gorilla that Ernie wasn't going to F with. "And from that day on, I was one of Carmine's guys," Ruggiero said. The new affiliation came with a requirement. Lombardozzi expected that members of his crew would find legitimate jobs to deflect law enforcement attention. Ruggiero had dim prospects. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selection by Mark Hoffman.